We'd like to welcome you all out for coming. Thank you for being here. And I'm Doug Anderson. I'm an ear, nose, and throat physician with the Ogden Clinic. I know many of you, some I don't. But I'm hopeful that because of this workshop, you'll feel like it was a collaborative learning effort, that we all helped each other out with our own insights and experience, because I don't proclaim to know everything. I've been in practice in Ogden about 25 years and seen and treated a lot of nosebleeds. I think everyone sort of finds things that work. One thing I have used is a consensus statement put out by our academy on treatment of epistaxis. And it's based on literature, it's graded on its evidence, and so I try to incorporate those in our lecture. But I do have, as far as goals for our lecture today, and I'm hoping you can all contribute, so if you need me to stop and you want to ask questions, you can. As you know, I have some little things that I've brought to show, some samples of things I have in a little kit, and we'll talk about that in a little bit later. But the goals that I have for today are to understand the causes of epistaxis, have a knowledge of recommendations to help prevent nosebleeds that you can give to your patients, establish a treatment algorithm that in your mind, if you know, what's the first thing I should try and go from there, and then understand situations that can make treatment of nosebleeds difficult. I'm sure all of you have had those situations where you just can't get the nose to stop bleeding, or you can't put the pack in. There's something not working right. And then also to be able to put together an epistaxis kit that will help improve our successful treatment. There was a physician, and he had a famous quote. His name was Chevalier Jackson, and he was the father of bronchoscopy. And he had a famous saying. He's passed away now, but he would put on these courses every year at Temple University. And I went to one of those courses after he had passed away, but they still were continuing on these courses. His quote was if you prepare for something that you're going to do in your office, you don't know when it's going to come in, but if you put in 2 minutes of preparation, your procedure could take 2 hours. But if you put in at least 2 hours of preparation, then the procedure you do will take about 2 minutes. And so and with that in mind, I think putting together an epistaxis kit is really helpful. And so we have like a little basket that we use in addition to things that we have in each of our rooms. Hopefully we'll talk about that here in a minute. And then I want you to have increased knowledge of what to consider if you just can't get the nose to stop bleeding, or if it just keeps recurring and they keep coming back, what are some other things that you can consider? So just as far as prevalence, about 60% of people in the U.S. will have at least one nosebleed at some point in their life. And it also must be noted that 6% of these people will need to seek medical attention. In addition, I think it's interesting that almost 0.5% of all ER visits are due to nosebleeds. Maybe some of you who work in the ER, or if you've worked in the ER, may find, you know, but this is according to the articles I read. And up to 1/3 of all ENT visits in the ER are secondary to nosebleeds. There is 70% are sort of iatrogenic or trauma or from comorbid conditions or medications. There seems to be a bimodal age distribution where a lot of the patients are either under the age of 10 or somewhere between 70 and 79 years of age. But certainly we see patients of all ages, but those are some common peak age groups that we tend to see. And it's an equal incidence between males and female. Certainly anatomical factors can play a risk, such as polyps or a deviated septum or maybe a tumor or telangiectasias or some other issue, or maybe infection going on. There certainly is environmental issues too. Perhaps the patient has allergic rhinitis, or they live in a very dry state, or they're on oxygen. So those are some things to think about. We do know in the winter months our air tends to be drier, and so we're more prone to nosebleeds. some people have coagulopathies or inherited conditions that make them prone to nosebleeds that we should be aware of. We all know about the different medications that are out there. Some may affect the function of the platelets. Others affect the coagulation cascade, different factors in that cascade. And some take longer to reverse and others less time. So there's a lot of things to consider. But certainly many of our patients have comorbid conditions that make them prone to nosebleeds, such as renal disease, which we know can affect the coagulation cascade. Liver disease and high blood pressure and certainly other issues. So what are some of the anatomical things that we may see that may make a person prone to nosebleeds? So this is a picture commonly seen, and so let's say someone comes into your office or clinic and they have a history of nosebleeds, and so first of all, I think it's very important that in your armamentarium that you have a headlight. You don't want to be trying to look in their nose and hold the headlight up, but makes it difficult to treat if you saw something. But this is a dilated vessel, and in my experience, if we were to say that this part of the nose is the anterior superior triangle or corner of the quadrangular cartilage, and this is the posterior inferior, right where it just sort of attaches right above the maxillary crest. But in that area, there are some vessels that sort of radiate in that area, but that whole sort of anterior area of the nose is called Kieselbeck's plexus, and a lot of vessels are in that area. But you can see this one's quite prominent and dilated, and so sometimes if you just were to gently rub that area with a Q-tip moistened with numbing medicine, even if it's not bleeding now, you can not only numb it, but you may stir up a fragile vessel to start bleeding. And then you sort of know, that's it. If you rub it and nothing happens, maybe keep looking. These are some polyps. And notice the color compared to like a turbinate down below. If you see on the left side, that's the color of a turbinate, more pinkish red. But polyps are, in general, more pale, although I have seen some sort of hemorrhagic colored polyps. Certainly some people have from trauma or infection, certainly in pregnancy you can see this, some pyogenic granulomas, and it's sort of a purpley vascular thing. Often they almost fall off if you suction them. But anyway, that's a pyogenic granuloma. This is a person who has hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias, and as you know, that can be a horrible thing. And probably many of you have seen those patients, and they have the classic telangiectasias on their lips or on their skin, but they can have those same lesions in the nose. And these can be very, very difficult to treat, and sometimes you may see them, and they're walking around with a hemoglobin of 5 or 7 just because they're chronically having issues with bleeding. They can be quite scary. Here's another patient with this disorder, and of course has these lesions on the lips, these telangiectasias. And then if you have a teenager, a male, 17-year-old male that comes in is having recurrent heavy nosebleeds, and you can't see where they're coming from, you know, I think you have to consider, is there something in the back of the nose? And so we know that juvenile nasopharyngeal angiofibromas can be seen in that age group, and so you have to at least consider that. And here's a CT scan of that angiofibroma. And then septal perforations. Maybe many of you have patients who have holes in their septum, perhaps from nose picking or trauma or surgery or using too many sprays or using cocaine. And it's common that they will have frequent recurrent nosebleeds along the margin of that hole. And it's a difficult thing to treat too, because the more you cauterize that rim, the bigger that hole is going to get over time and perhaps make their symptoms of nasal issues worse, which could be congestion or sinusitis or further bleeding and crusting. So what are some things that we can prevent? I know many of you already know this, so I'll go through this rather quickly. But if any of you think, oh, I do this or I recommend another thing, you know, please raise your hand. But certainly humidifiers, saline sprays or gels, or salves. You know, there's some salves out there that have sort of mineral oils in them. A couple that are common out there, one's called Alka-Lol, not alcohol, but Alka-Lol. And it just has it's sort of saline with some minerals, oils in them. And another is Poneris spray. And so those are some options you can get a hold of and they can help. Certainly AYR gel and saline gel, and I'm not supposed to mention any names, product names. I'll try not to. If I slip, forgive me. But I have no commercial endorsements. I am on the on a research thing for Inspire, and we enroll our patients in Inspire, and we do get a stipend for that, but it has nothing to do with this lecture. So the other things that we can tell our patients is to avoid the excessive use of sprays. So some patients are on different sprays for their allergies that may fluticasone, for example, is one. And there's others that have fluticasone plus other medicines that help with allergic rhinitis. And so those, if they're sprayed inappropriately towards the septum, can cause irritation and crusting and bleeding. And certainly we know that there's other medications. People that are on diuretics may dry them out or other medications. Certainly we need to caution them about avoiding picking their nose or that. We always were told that if there was some that came in and said they never picked their nose, they were a liar. So especially if they were male. But there's a lot of nose pickers out there, unfortunately. But so just caution them on that. Then to treat the underlying infections, if you see they have an infection or if they have allergies, you want to control those better. And you can treat anatomical abnormalities, whether it be polyps or granulomas or other things like that. And then make sure that they have humidification if they're on oxygen. So 95% of nosebleeds are coming from the anterior part of the nose, that Kieselbach's plexus, and which is supplied by both the external and the internal carotid artery, specifically from the superior labial, the sphenopalatine artery, and the greater palatine artery, and then also the anterior ethmoidal artery. So those are the vessels that sort of come together and form this plexus. 5% of nosebleeds are posterior, and they are generally supplied by the sphenopalatine artery and the terminal branches of the internal maxillary artery. And so I would say, in my experience, most of the time, those posterior nosebleeds are coming from adults in, between 60 and 80 years of age, and usually they can bleed out the front of their nose, but often they bleed out both sides heavily because it's at the back of the nose. It can go either right or left, and a lot is going down the back of the throat. And the traditional, you may put in a pack, and if it's not far enough back, it's going to just keep bleeding down the back of their throat. And so that's something to keep in mind. So here's a picture of the Kieselbach's plexus in that brownish circle there, and you can see the vessels that are feeding it that we talked about. And then, of course, the posterior portions of the sphenopalatine artery, just an anterior to the sphenoid sinus in the face of the sphenoid, is where posterior nosebleeds come from. And really, it comes from, and I'll show you later, the posterior middle meatus there. So what is the treatment algorithm? And so the treatment algorithm is that we, that person, before they get in trouble, should obviously right away put pressure to the lower third of the nose and hold it firmly for 5 minutes. It's amazing, a lot of people don't do that. They'll put ice on, or they'll lay down, but they don't really just put pressure on their nose. And then obviously, if that's not successful and you're worried about that they've lost lots of blood, you obviously need to check vital signs and consider ABCs. Position, again, if they're just coming in with a bad nosebleed and their vital signs are good, you want to keep them sitting up, not laying down, because otherwise it may compromise their airway. It may go down the back of their throat. They may be swallowing it, and that can cause some problems too. So keep them sitting up and leaning forward just a little bit and holding pressure on that lower third of the nose. And then obviously, if you can, and some of this can be done at the same time, try to get a history. Are they on blood thinners? Is there a family history of bleeding disorders? And has there been recent trauma or recent surgery? And so those are important. And then if you're concerned about excessive blood loss, if in the history you say they've thrown up a sink full of blood, then I'd get some labs and apply some topical medications. We apply obviously Afrin, but there's topical adrenaline. There's you can apply some numbing medicine at the same time, whether it be lidocaine or cocaine or ponacaine, to numb it for any potential treatment. Some people use tranexamic acid, and that works well. There's been some studies that talk about that. We'll talk about that. Certainly, cautery is effective in many cases. Nasal packing is effective, and often about 20% of the time you've done that, you've also done cautery too. And then if you're concerned about the amount of blood or the age group, or maybe you saw something in the nose, consider a CT scan. And then if things are not getting better, then someone has to take a look further back in the nose with a scope or something to see, is there a mass back there that you need to worry about? And then you start thinking about surgical, whether it be a biopsy or an endoscopic clipping of that sphenopalatine artery or interventional radiology. So this is things that we use commonly. And so if you want with your phone, you can maybe take a picture of it. And this isn't like, this is just what I thought of. It's not like from a book or anything like that, but you may think other things that work, but certainly a headlight is important, speculum, suction, appropriate nasal instruments, bayonet forceps, we say, are important, topical medications, Q-tips, cotton pledgets, and ones that we use. If I can reach here. So ones that we use are, these are just cotton pledgets. They're like little strips of compressed cotton with a little string on it so you don't lose. So you can look at that, and there's probably different brands. So that's something. Again, these are the bayonet forceps, the nasal speculum to expose, and then certainly different medications. And then there's a variety of different packs. Like I say, I don't have any financial interest in any nasal packing company, and so here's some different varieties. So I would say, though, you may want to have a combination of some non-dissolvable packing, for example, Vaseline-coated strip gauze, or maybe a Maricel sponge that is not dissolvable, or a Rapid Rhino pack that has sort of a balloon in it. But you also may want to have some dissolvable types of packing, and those are important, especially in the patient that's on a blood thinner, and you're going to try to do this without having them stop their blood thinner, because those you don't have to worry about them rebleeding when you take out the pack. So I can just do it by hand. So these are just some examples of different things. Tranexamic acid is an antifibrinolytic, and there's been studies that show, it may be effective. So they, the Cochrane Review, many of you have heard of Cochrane Reviews. They sort of look at the literature, and they, after their thorough review of the literature, they said there is a moderate quality evidence that there is probably a reduction in the risk of rebleeding with the use of either oral or topical tranexamic acid in addition to the usual treatments you use, whether it be packing or cautery or whatever. So that's an adjunct. And as far as given intravenously, we usually recommend a gram IV, or the topical can be given like 200 milligrams on a dry, like, roll of cotton and left in there for like 10 minutes, and then you can reapply it if you need to. But those are some things you can do. So we talked about pressure, and then there's cautery, I would think if you looked at the consensus statement by our academy, probably people recommend bipolar if you have it. Some people don't have it in their office. And if you have a, let's see if I have it. But there are some bipolar cauteries. I'm not sure what I did with mine, but that basically look like this. But it's an insulated tip, so it doesn't have things that collect on it, but and it's just a cord and it cauterizes, and the rest is sort of insulated so it doesn't burn the nose, the alar rims in the nose. And then the other is a silver nitrate, which I use most of the time in my office. And I think if done appropriately, most of the time, unless it's a large bleeder, most of those anterior nosebleeds, I think, can be controlled with silver nitrate. Now, I don't recommend, so if someone comes in and I don't see a source and it doesn't bleed when I rub it, I don't just cauterize just thinking that'll do it. I got to see a bleeder. And so I'm going to show you a video here. This is it Command Tab? Okay. So this is from the Mayo Clinic here. And they're going to be doing, it's just 2 minutes long, a little cautery using silver nitrate. And this is
I'm Dr. Erin O'Brien, the Division Chair for Rhinology at Mayo Clinic Rochester. I'm going to go through a simple technique for managing epistaxis with silver nitrate. This patient has had recurrent epistaxis on the right side, and though not actively bleeding, we saw this spot on the right anterior septum, which was likely the culprit of her anterior epistaxis. I'm anesthetizing the area with topical lidocaine with phenylephrine on a cotton ball, and we can see this area with a prominent vessel or some granulation tissue. And after we anesthetize it, then I'm going to apply silver nitrate. I leave the cotton ball just behind this area. The silver nitrate can be messy. I'm just going to apply it on the area where it likely has been bleeding, and indeed, once I touch it, it does start bleeding. After using the silver nitrate, my next tip is going to be to use a cotton tip applicator or Q-tip right over that area. It holds that silver nitrate on that area to allow it to cauterize. You may still notice that it is friable or it may bleed again. I'll often do a second application, and here we do another silver nitrate stick to apply some fresh silver nitrate, still a little bit oozy. And again, the more important thing is that second Q-tip on this area. It holds that silver nitrate on while it's working. And I've got that area bleeding one more time, another application. Again, it's just localized. You can get burn through the septum if you're too liberal with your silver nitrate. So just to the area that you need to treat. A cotton-tipped applicator again. Also wipe away the excessive silver nitrate, and then I remove that cotton ball. Now if it started bleeding excessively, I could put that cotton ball back on easily. So important points, use silver nitrate only on the spot that's bleeding, and after applying silver nitrate, I hold it in place with a dry Q-tip. You can apply it multiple times, but try to focus it and make sure it's well anesthetized. In this video, we used a zero-degree endoscope, but you can
So a couple of things I would just say is I do it very similar, but I anesthetize with a Q-tip instead. She put like a cotton strip in there, and I sort of also, you'll see most of the time if you find the vessel, it's like either a dilated vessel like I showed you at the first, or a little papule, a red papule, and just touching it gently with the numbing medicine numbs it, but also it starts to bleed pretty quickly, pretty easily without a lot. And then you just cauterize, you hold pressure, and then the idea is the second Q-tip, I don't know, but it just sort of holds the silver nitrate against the lesion a little longer, but it also soaks up a little extra silver nitrate. And then the other thing at the end, I will put a little saline gel because that sort of inactivates further silver nitrate so it doesn't go down the throat and you're swallowing this cautery thing in the throat, so a little saline gel. So there are some difficult situations we talked about that may be difficult, and so we're gonna address those here in a second. So we talked about the silver nitrate. So there's packing, anterior versus posterior packing. You know, the anterior pack may be about 5 centimeters. The anterior posterior is like 7.5 centimeters. If you can't get the bleeding stop, I would try either a rapid rhino or another trick is you can put a Foley catheter, like a 12 French Foley catheter in the back of the throat, inflate it with 10 mLs of saline, and then pull it to the front. You can even cut off a little you know, right above the hub where the syringe goes on, you can just cut a little strip of that, and so it acts like a little, like a tie slide that you'd use for scouts, and you just fold the excess catheter and you slide that on there, and it cinches it up against the nose as you pull it. So, and I can explain it, but anyway, so now you've kept the blood from going down the back of the throat, especially this is important in a patient that's difficult to pack because they have a crooked septum. Then you can use that Vaseline strip gauze and just pack it in there. And this shows a picture of how to do that here. I'll show you here in a second. So this is how you layer that packing in. And so this is a way you can do it. Just put in about as much packing as the length of the bayonet forceps, lay it in there, and then get another layer and on top, so just on top of it. And that will compress. And I know we're going to sort of speed up here. These are different kinds of packs you can see. These you put in and then moisten with saline. I usually lubricate them with antibiotic ointment first. This is another kind that can be inserted in this way. And this is a kind that has a balloon in the center that you can add some air. Some have some are shorter and some are longer. The longer ones obviously can get anterior and posterior. This is it's called an Epistat. I haven't seen any of these in the ER lately. And then again, this is the gauze with the balloon that I talked to you about, the Foley catheter, and then layering the gauze anteriorly. So if you had a really crooked septum and the stiff old Maricel sponge wouldn't go in there, that's an option. And then surgery is a possibility. And again, you may want to do an anterior rhinoscopy to evaluate the posterior nasal cavity. You get a CT scan to make sure there's not a tumor back there. May need biopsies, may need a septoplasty. And then you may need clipping of what we call the sphenopalatine artery. And this is a little bit of a picture. It's hard to see, but it's basically we do it like a sinus surgery. We're going just a little bit further back than where we do the window for the maxillary sinus. We lift up the mucosa. There's a vessel that's coming out that's tense there. It's about equal with the posterior wall of the maxillary sinus. We just put a clip there. And it really works pretty well. So, and that just sort of gives you the area at the back where that vessel is coming out. There, just in front of the sphenoid sinus. And so, and then the other is sometimes we, depending on the patient and what problems they have, maybe they can't tolerate surgery, is interventional radiology where they put a catheter in and they basically put a little sponge or coil in the distal branches of the IMF, the internal maxillary artery, and sometimes the facial artery. Sometimes they do both sides. And the amazing thing is blood flow is reestablished within 2 to 8 days. And I do usually put in a little packing, but I usually just keep it in a day for that, and then I pull it out. A lot of people will say, well, how long do you keep packing in once I pack someone? I personally, we were always taught 3 days, but I know the literature talks about 24 to 72 hours. And obviously, if it's prolonged amount, I would definitely have them on antibiotics too, just so you don't get an infection, a sinus infection or a staph infection. So here's the embolization. Are there any questions at all? Yeah, Frank. Yeah.
Almost like a little bony ridge there, but it can be pretty vigorous bleeding.
Yes.
And I have a difficult time anesthetizing that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any tricks that you can do?
No, that's a great question. So that's right where the foramen is, right down by that maxillary crest coming up right here, that bony part where they come together, and that posterior inferior septal angle. And that's frequently, and sometimes you almost like feel if you're using silver nitrate, dipping into a little bit of a hole there. But that's where that vessel's coming out, and sometimes you have to hold. But as far as anesthetizing, I always just use topical, but I'll spend a lot of time topical. Sometimes I'll use spray first, and then topical with a sponge, and I'll leave it in there a little bit of time. But, you know, you could always inject if you had to, but I just think that, you know, sometimes, once you numb it with the topical, usually they don't feel the injection that much, so you could do a little injectable lidocaine. I think there was another question.
So is it just viscous lidocaine that you're using?
Yeah, you could use 2% viscous lidocaine. We have in our thing a little topical 4% lidocaine, and it's just it's liquidy, and so we can spray it in if we want to, or we can soak the pledgets a little bit so they're wet, and we put in the cotton with that, so it's topical 4% lidocaine. So, yeah.
So, in my world, in clinic, I don't see a lot of active nosebleeds.
Right.
Some people who come in that say they previously had nosebleeds,
yeah.
A lot will say, you know, they just want
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I look in their nose, and I guess the question is, when you see these patients, and they're not actively bleeding, but they have in the past, how often do you cauterize their nose? Are you just looking for an abnormal blood vessel, or is that what you go after?
So that's a great question. So what I do is I try to establish a site. So this is probably one of the more important questions, is you never want to cauterize both sides, because you'll get a septal perforation. So never do both sides. So you cauterize one side, you come back 6 weeks later and do the other side. And if they get a bleed on the other side, you can pack it. But so you say, well, is there one side that's more than another? If they're older and they're saying, well, it's both sides and it's heavy, I start thinking, you know, maybe they need some, maybe I need to do a CT scan to look back there, is it coming posteriorly? But so once I get a side, if they say, oh, it's both sides, but the right side's definitely more often, I will take a Q-tip and I dip it in the topical, you know, some Afrin and 4% lidocaine, and I will just gently rub the side of the septum, and usually if there's a fragile vessel, it'll start to bleed. So, you know, most of the time you can see a little vessel there and you're not sure if it is, but if you rub it, just sort of rub it a little bit, and you do that for a little bit, number one, you're numbing it. Number two, it starts to bleed. Now, if nothing happens, but I would say most of the time, if a person comes in with a history of bleeding and they can tell me a side, I almost always can find a bleeder. If it's a trustable history, then almost always I can find the bleeder just by doing what I said and then cauterize, and they're happy with it. But sometimes they'll come back and say, well, now the left side's bleeding. And so I'll wait 4 weeks. You know, if they have to, they can pack it and before then, but then I'll do the other side. So
that one picture you had up there a while back showed kind of two vessels that were sort of long.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you see that, are you cauterizing the entire length of that big blood vessel and then going after the second two? I mean,
So that's a great question. On that one, I probably would get both vessels. But usually one side, at one site, it'll start pumping out, maybe at the convergence or maybe up the limb, and I'll cauterize around that. And it sort of depends, but sometimes you're literally chasing your tail. You cauterize one area, and that stops, but right at the margin of where you stop cautering, a little bit bleeds a little bit more. But at the same time, I'm not really saying you just ought to cauterize the whole side, because I think too much silver nitrate may be not the best. But I would, if, you know, sometimes you end up doing that a little bit. And the other thing I would say is sometimes you'll see a little silver stain around their nostril as some of that silver nitrate leaks out. And so it's like a pen mark on their skin. I just tell them, don't worry, it's going to go away. But at the same time, that's where they use the dry Q-tip after sort of soaks up some of that stuff. And then the saline maybe keeps it from going down the back of their throat a little bit. Yes.
We see it frequently where people come in, because I work ER, and where they're super hypertensive, you know, blood pressure is 210 or something like that, and they just, the whole septum just oozes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's hard. I would try to find a definite bleeder if you can. If it's maybe everything's oozing, it may be better, to be honest with you, especially if they're on blood thinners, to put a pack in and let that, just because I think otherwise you expose cartilage, a lot of cartilage. And while the cartilage potentially can get blood supply from the other side, it's going to take a long time to heal as that skin recovers the cartilage. And so as it's healing, you know, potentially it's a crust there, and the patients are picking at that crust, and then it rebleeds. It's sort of a tough thing, so. Yeah. Let me show you what I do. So I really, when I first came out of practice, I would pack it a little firmer, but once I have silver nitrate, if I felt confident and I've done the dry sponge after, I don't see that it rebleeds, I try to lightly pack it, because I feel like the silver nitrate did the trick. But I want to keep their, I don't want them to traumatize it. And so we just, there's these little sponges you can get, sort of like a gel foam. And you can get these little sponges. And I get some of those, and I dip it in a little ointment, maybe just a little saline, because that sort of inactivates the silver nitrate. And I just sort of cover it a little bit. And I realize they may sneeze and it may fall off, but it's a little coating for a little bit to protect it. And so I, but if I'm really worried that these are heavy gushing bleeds, then I may put a pack in for a few days. And again, there's different packs. Some are dissolvable. You know, this is sort of the material of the dissolvable stuff, or this. Some of them have they're a sort of they're like an antibiotic type thing. And others are permanent. They have to come out. You know, these are more permanent. They have to come out. So if I'm thinking I'm worried about taking them out and rebleeding, then I put in a dissolvable one. Yeah, I think you can use whatever you want, and I don't know if there is. Some people say just Vaseline is fine, or saline gel, to be honest with you. So I sometimes do an antibiotic, especially if there's lots of crusting in there, just to help. But and you could use whatever. I use mupirocin, but you could use polysporin or bacitracin or whatever brand you want. I've certainly used. Yeah, I don't have any experience with that, but I'm sure that's possible, and that's probably, you know, the idea between some of these sprays that have a little bit of some oils in them, just to lubricate a little bit. So definitely, I think that's. I just don't have experience. Does anyone else have experience with Eucerin? That may be a good one. I don't know. So one thing, another just tip I would say is, I would say when you put in your pack, you know, remember. You're not, even though we think, oh, you follow the bridge of the nose, it's almost a down. Can you see that angle? It's more of a down, and that's you're following the inferior turbinate. Now, it may be that on top of that, you have to put a shorter pack, because remember, the skull base goes this direction. And so up higher, you're going to have something shorter. And so sometimes I'll take these packs, I'll put a longer one, I'll get a second one, I'll cut it up into smaller pieces and tuck it up higher. And so that may help you a little bit too. So, yes.
I don't have any familiarity with the dissolvable nasal vaccines. Like, I'm just curious, number one, like what product I might buy to use in clinic, and then
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's a ton of different products, and again, I have no financial interest in any of them, but some of them, you know, I think some of the major companies like Medtronic, there's a company called Posicep or Medpor. I don't know, but I would check the costs, you know, whatever seems like it's economically, because I think they're all similar. Some of the products like have chitosan in, which is almost like made out of, I guess, crustacean stuff, but anyway, so chitosan is supposed to help with infection, and it's dissolvable, and it has some hemostatic properties to it. So some of them have that in, this brand is just called Hemopore. I'm not even sure who is Stryker, and it supposedly it's colored a little bit, but it's supposed to help with. I don't know if that color helps with the bleeding, but also maybe a little bit of antibacterial too. So anyway, so. You know, and the summer pace, I don't really use the pace because I think you need pressure, but some are like you can go back and forth between two syringes. Yeah, so that's another thing you may find, the ones you like. Some of them take longer to dissolve, and they're really granular and messy, and takes a lot of time to get them out of there. Others dissolve pretty quickly, just turn into a dissolvable mush, you know, almost like a... you know, some thick mucus, really. So that may be influence which kind you buy. And that's sort of a trial and error thing. You may just decide ones you like better than others.
For the transexamic acid, are there any contraindications that you know of? And then, in general, like you mentioned, with those broad bleeders where I can't find something, can you just put the whole cotton swab in? And is there any, so silver nitrate, you don't want to put across the entire septum?
Yeah. Yeah, so that article I referred to earlier, and they say it's fairly safe. It's safe, and I would have to be honest with you. I'd have to look, and I'm sure everything has its potential side effects. And for tranexamic, since it's an anti-fibrinolytic, it maybe increase clots elsewhere, I guess. But so maybe make sure they don't have a hypercoagulable state or something. But I say it's other than that. According to this article, it's very safe. Surprisingly, they say it's very inexpensive. That's what this article said. And I mean, I never checked the price. I want to use it, but we use it a lot for post tonsillectomy bleeds and then also it can be used in the nose. And so again, it's this 200 milligrams per topical application, and you can do it once or twice, I think. And IV, it can be given a gram. In tonsils, we nebulize it, you know, so. But they say it's very safe and not expensive. Any other questions? Does anyone else have any thoughts of things they've done that have been successful? You may have some things that you have done, but. Okay, thank you for coming and attending. Hope you enjoy the rest of your meeting. Thank you so much.